Just a little background, what motivates modern public health? Social justice, that should be healthy people, 2010, it's full of good social justice rhetoric. I feel like I'm reading stuff from the 60s again. Integrated delivery systems and the NIH's future public health study. They've bemoaned the status of public health and decided the solution to be to just make everything public health, and that would, of course, make it better. Or comments I've heard from at least one unnamed state health director, it's about our patients, referring, of course, to those people in their clinics and their control programs, not to society. We look at the APHA's view of this. Their vision is healthy people and healthy communities. Promote physical and mental health and prevent disease, injury, and disability. I did miss World Peace and Universal Brotherhood, but I think it's buried in the essential services. Now, they do have some good lists, and if they start at the top, it looks like public health. Prevents epidemics and the spread of disease. Protects against environmental hazards. That's good. Prevents injuries. Well, it's something we should do, but maybe it's public health. Healthy behaviors, wellness, that's important stuff. You know, whether I smoke or take my hypertensive medication or meditate, I don't know if that's public health. Response, disasters, and assist communities in recovery. Well, that's kind of broad. Public health disasters, great. Other disasters, who knows? I'm not sure the fire department's comfortable with that one. Assures the quality and accessibility of health services. Well, that gets murky when we start looking at the essential public health services, because in fact, they're health services. And we discover that by health services, it's a huge umbrella. It's not just whether your restaurants get inspected correctly. Monitor health status to identify community health problems. If you've been in this business long, you know that the words we use are very loaded. I remember when Dean Stallings of the School of Public Health used to talk about, criticize people who talked about health care, because he said, we're not talking about health care, we're talking about medical care. And, you know, the notion has been make it even broader, that health is this huge umbrella. But I'll argue it covers a lot of stuff that needs to be done, but if we try to do it in public health, it undermines our support and our ability to do the stuff that no one else is interested in doing. Diagnose and investigate health problems and health hazards. Inform, educate, empower. What a great word. People about health issues. I know the whole bioethics movement spent two decades to empower people about health care choice, and that the end result is the HMOs came in and we have less choice than we ever had before. Be wary of what you wish for. Mobilize community partnerships to identify and solve health problems. Could be vigilantes. Develop policies and plans that support individual and community health efforts. There's where we get the key. We start continuing to talk about individual health. Enforce laws, and I like that one, regulations. Link people to needed health services. Assure the provision of health care when otherwise unavailable. Personal health care workforce. Quality of personal health services. When we look at these, we see that, in fact, the APHA has a very big umbrella. Covers everything you can think of that deals with healthy mind and healthy bodies. It kind of sounds like the old Boy Scout manual. I'm not sure that we can do that task, that any one agency can do that task. Now, let me say, in the law school world, one of the things I'm cursed with is teaching administrative law, which is how agencies work. And as most lawyers will remember, it is the most disliked course in law school, avoided by most lawyers if possible, because they haven't figured out it's half of what they'll do. One of the problems with it is that we have a whole lot of agencies that do a whole lot of different things differently, and the students never figure out how to make sense of it. I'm not saying we shouldn't do these functions. In fact, I would say we should do all of them and let truth be known. I'd probably have socialized medicine pretty quickly. But I am saying that we need to rethink whether we want to do them within the public health umbrella. The reason is that we have vastly different skill sets. We have different finance models. We have different professional paradigms. We have different and conflicting legal authority. And finally, different political bases. When we try to do all of these things under the same umbrella, we undermine our ability to do any one of them effectively. Now, since this is public health law, I'm going to talk more about the law first. It's essentially four sources of legal authority, broadly characterizable as parens patriae. We'll talk about what each of these means. Police powers, criminal law, and individual liberties law. Parens patriae, to use the old definition, parent means literally parent of the country. It's the principle that the state must care for those who cannot take care of themselves, such as minors who lack proper care and custody from their parents. This was the notion, and it's very deeply rooted in Anglo-American jurisprudence, of the king as father, the country as family. And it had very interesting ramifications. The king wasn't caring for his subjects just to be a nice guy and a good daddy. He cared for them because if they weren't healthy, they couldn't defend him when the neighboring countries tried to invade. So it was essentially a model where I care for the citizens of my country so they can defend me. So parens patriae is probably what most of you would think of as what should motivate us. It's taking care of people. Now, modern legal doctrines, we see this most clearly in child welfare, indigent care, wellness programs, mental health care. These are things we're trying to take care of people. Our question is, why do lawyers like this so much? Because if you go to law schools and look at legal books, you'll find parens patriae is kind of the dominant way we like to look at things. First, it helps the downtrodden. That makes you feel better about yourself. It empowers the individual. It embodies the trust, distrust of the state. One of the problems we have in public health, and frankly, in government, in all government agencies, is in this tremendous tension between wanting the state to help people and distrusting the state. When we get into public health, we see enormous distrust of the state. We look at all the history of AIDS legislation. So much of that is fraught with the tension between wanting the state to provide services but not trusting the state. More mundanely, parens patriae, all this stuff about individuals, generates money for lawyers. You can sue for those individuals, sue to get those services, and make some money on the side. Probably the most critical, maybe the most critical legal point to make in this whole talk, just as an aside to thinking about public health, there's not much money in representing the state in public health. And there's no private practice in public health. Now, we tend to think of the state as this giant, infinitely funded behemoth that just rolls over anyone in its path. But I'm sure there's nobody who's done local public health here who thinks of that when you're thinking about your legal support from the city legal office or the county legal office. In fact, you can get outgunned by a junior clerk at some law firm. However, our whole approach to public health, particularly from the law schools, is based on distrust of government. You read an administrative law textbook, 90% of the cases are about how to fight with agencies. Because in fact, you don't get a lot of lawyers doing the work to support agencies. That's what the government does, not what the private bar does. So one of the things that undermines good public health law is that unless you can make a lot of money at it, it isn't important in the law world. And we've seen that even in tangential areas, disability law and the like. What really empowered disability law? The ability to sue for damages, because then you can build a bar. Now, police power. Some of the grayer heads in the room will remember this as the core of public health, the right of societal self-defense, or also called the right of the state to protect itself, or and to protect its citizens. The model being, though, you protect citizens in order to protect the state, not to protect citizens just to protect them as individuals. It's Old English common law. It was the core function of the colonial governments. It was a key power reserved to the states in the Constitution, and essentially the key public health doctrine until the 80s. And absent statutory modifications at the state or federal level, it's still the way the courts resolve public health disputes when they look at them doctrinally. Now, how do these differ? Why should you care? There was a wonderful statement of this in a case from the late 70s, Addington v. Texas. It was Texas trying to civilly commit a mentally ill man, and it was arguing over the correct standard of proof. And the defendant argued that since you're going to lock me up, you have to prove your case by the same standard as a criminal conviction, a beyond a reasonable doubt standard. The state said, no, we're not locking you up to punish you, we're locking you up to take care of you and to protect the rest of us, so we only have to use a lower standard of proof. Supreme Court resolved it in the state's favor, but gave us this very clear statement. The state has a legitimate interest under its parents' patriot powers in providing care to its citizens who are unable, because of emotional disorders, to care for themselves. The state also has the authority under its police power to protect the community from the dangerous tendencies of some who are mentally ill. So protecting the community is police power, even if you benefit the individual in the process. And parents patriae is helping the individual, although you will benefit the community in the process. Now, philosophical differences, the individual is first in parents patriae. Now, you wouldn't think that when you look at some of the sexual offender laws, but these things do get knocked off the tracks a little bit. The notion that you have a fairly limited balancing between individual and societal rights, and ultimately that society is just the sum of individuals. Police power has an ecological model, looking at society as a complex organism. Now, practical differences. Parents patriae is driven by individual, usually medical needs. Individual lives trump the statistical lives. The notion of protecting yourself, that's very parents patriae. Probably the most critical is when we talk about parents patriae disease control and education and empowerment, working under it is what I call the informed op-ed. We usually concede that, well, if you really want to go ahead and do it, you can. How do the informed consent to be a bad citizen? And that undermines a lot of empowerment, education-based control strategies. Ultimately, we won't make you do it. Sometimes that's okay, sometimes it's problematic. Police power is really to protect others from disease, so we don't allow an informed op-out. Because, in fact, we don't care about your life and health, at least not as compared to the community. That's a very deep practical difference. You look at the 1905 Supreme Court case on immunizations, Jacobson versus U.S., which was over the allowability of a criminal penalty for failing to get an immunization. The court talks eloquently about the duty to give up certain personal autonomy for the state. And the court was sensitive in those days that 1905 smallpox immunizations were kind of risky. There's some reasonable argument that they might have done in a reasonable number of people. Now, one of the other theories is criminal law. Probably doctrinally, it's a subset of the police powers, although they've diverged enough we don't need to think of it that way. It always has had a moral and religious overlay. It is related to public health in that deterrence may prevent bad behavior, and if we've got you in the slammer, your occasion for bad behavior is limited. The core constitutional difference is that it allows punishment, which police power public health does not allow. And because of that, it has a lot of constitutional protections. But criminal law is one of our theories that's involved in public health. There are times when the behavior is so abhorrent to society, we criminalize it. Finally, the individual liberties law, which is really derived from Bill of Rights, limits balancing of the individual's rights against societal. Privacy law, tort law, informed consent, other medical law doctrines. Probably the best expression of that is the physician-patient relationship. And this is also one of the key reasons why I argue that personal health services, stuff where you have a physician-patient relationship, are uniquely undermine the public health model and public health authority and provide probably an insoluble conflict of interest. You have trust as fundamental. Legally, in every state, it's treated as a fiduciary obligation. That the informed consent law derives from that, which includes informed refusal. Except under very limited circumstances, people may refuse care, even to their own detriment. And of course, where have we seen this become really controversial is HMOs, which bribe your doctor or coerce your doctor into limiting your choice, violating the fiduciary duty. And as a society, we have yet to figure out how to resolve that. Key issues are the patient's interest. It's crossed with public health. We get a lot of problems. Look at all the furor over drug testing pregnant women and involuntary civil commitment. Those are ones where the advocates for the patient versus the advocates for societal interests are butting heads because these are very difficult to resolve. The problem is that if the person with the physician-patient relationship is also wearing the public health hat, that conflict of interest either undermines the patient's trust in the physician or undermines the physician's ability to act as a public health enforcement agent. Now, there are also administrative conflicts. Any of you that are in departments that do personal medical services know that they're expensive. The demand for services is unlimited. One of the criticisms that Texas has gotten is they have this not a terribly good image of care system. But Texas has an infinite ocean of poor people who flow across the border. I'm not sure you could ever have working indigent care in Texas because the demand is insatiable. The providers are expensive. There's an enormous emotional pull involved. We got little Timmy in your office and little Timmy's sick, and we got to take care of little Timmy. We have sick pregnant women. We have sick grannies. That focuses people's attention, draws resources. Contrast it with public health. You went out and interviewed most politicians, much less the citizenry. They don't have much of an idea what's going on in core public health, but they all know we need to take care of little Timmy. And so when they have to vote, unless they've had a recent major foodborne illness outbreak in their region or the like, they're going to vote for money for little Timmy. Remember when the first oceans of money started flowing into HIV research? Where did it come from? Most of the other areas of public health. So we have this resource capture. Now, again, we should be doing this. We as a country should be providing basic health services as a right. My argument, however, is that it ought to come from a different place than public health. And the more we embrace it, the less resources we'll have for public health. Then we have the medical police problem. Public health is about reporting, contact tracing, warning, coercive actions, nosy stuff like vital statistics. Maybe we ought to call it the three C's, count, control, and coerce. Well, when your doc starts doing that, you get really nervous. When you get criminal law into the mix, you know, imagine going to your doc and telling your deepest secrets, and oh my God, the doc's going to report me to the police. That's led physicians, and that's particular for this group, who are in public health, especially those that are really acute care medicine physicians, not public health physicians, to reject the whole public health paradigm. that's really problematic when those people are the head of health department, state or local, and they're talking to legislators. Now, the skill sets problem. This is the failing of schools of public health, among other things. If this umbrella is so huge, then there's a lot of different skills you have to teach. Trying to put together an organization to teach those skills is difficult. Schools of public health have utterly failed at this mission for perfectly understandable reasons. I'm an academic. I've learned the game. I was in the real world once, and I can still remember it some. When you're in an academic world, in a school of public health, or any other research university, you will not get tenure and survive unless you get grants and do research. And there's no grant money to train people to recognize one rat from another or to inspect a restaurant. It's not doing state-of-the-art research. One of my favorite public health lawyers was tenured in the School of Public Health because before he got into law, he was an ace arthropod vector guy, chased mosquitoes around the swamps. I'm not sure they'd have ever tenured him if he'd done the law first. So we have this problem that the only place that's really focusing on this is schools of public health, yet their faculty in the research university model have almost nothing to do with most of the skills of public health. Has one other problem. Since everything is public health, you don't have admissions requirements. So public health schools turning out poor public health people probably ought to require biology, bacteriology, science-based education. But in fact, schools of public health tend to let people in with any type of background because public health's anything you want it to be. Bottom line is, because someone has an MPH, tells you nothing about whether they could go into a restaurant and know whether there's a problem, whether they could have, whether they could explain to you why it is we do animal control and it's not to protect the rights of the animals. In reality, I have an MPH and I did not take a single useful course dealing with poor public health. I know it because I started out as a biological sciences guy. And my wife's a public health physician who ran health departments for years, so I got a lot of on-the-job training. But it certainly doesn't come from the School of Public Health I went to. Now that's a terrific problem when you're trying to deal with the collapse of public health infrastructure, whether your food sanitation's done right, whether they put enough chlorine in the water. Now, community support problems. This is a political issue. If you read political choice stuff about providing, say, national health services, and in fact, the ill-fated Clinton health plan, pardon me to say that word, was based on a rational choice. You cannot get this country to back doing a big program for poor people. You have to make it a society-wide benefit. One of the things that may be wrong, but it is the reality. When you have pariah populations, be they drug addicts, the mentally ill, indigent care issues, you lose a lot of societal consensus. We still have to deal with those problems, but we know one of the reasons the United States has such terrible track record of dealing with problems like indigent care is this breakdown of the political consensus. Well, in reality, poor public health, food, water, nuisance, communicable disease control, has a very broad public support. You know, I can walk into a room of everything from the most left-wing social workers in Boulder, Colorado, which I did once, to physicians groups, to conservative politicians and talk poor public health and get a lot of support. Yet, as soon as you start making that umbrella bigger, that support evaporates. The problem, though, is that as public health, we only need a little bit of money. And when that support starts to evaporate, that other giant monster, personal health services, eats it up. Now, let's get back to War of the Big Ten. I worked with ASCO in 87 on a report on HIV confidentiality and reporting. And it was very interesting because it was a real exercise in We had health directors that had public health backgrounds. We had health directors that had acute services backgrounds, and they split on the issue. One of the principles of agency law is that the courts defer to agencies because the agencies have expertise. So the courts look to the agency for expertise. As soon as the agencies are all over the map, do not speak with a single voice, then the court's deference to agency expertise gets eroded quickly. And in fact, that's been a major issue. The Institute of Medicine's report, Future of Public Health, dealt with the difficulty of maintaining public health professionals and professional track. It has a lot to do with this problem that we have gotten a lot of departments, even if they don't do a lot of clinical services, they're captured by a clinical services mentality, or they become part of the state's social welfare. Some states' public health is dealt with the same with the Medicare and Medicaid flow-throughs and the WIC programs. Some of the issues are simple. The individual liberties law is not public health law. Final one, though, is agency cost. You can pass a law that gives an individual a lot of rights against the government. You can also do that by just making it difficult for the agency to do their work. One of the key strategies in protecting individuals from government action is to increase due process requirements. In public health, this has been an acute problem because most public health departments do not have a well-funded independent legal staff. As you increase due process requirements, you paralyze the agency. It's even difficult for law students to catch on until you finally get them to think about how you'd have to work as an agency. One of the worst problems we have in public health is that because we are so worried about all those personal health services protections and individual rights, we have increased the whole agency cost for every type of enforcement they do. And that bleeds over. It's harder to get the dog cases done. It's harder to get the restaurants closed. Someone was telling me last night in a large northwestern state that would go unnamed, it might take you a year to finally get a fine against somebody for a restaurant violation. Now, a sip of water and then a solution. One caveat. Some states have already done some of this. Some states haven't. Some localities have done this. Some haven't. Public health is a mixed bag. Disaggregate public health services. Separate out personal medical services. Define a core public health. Recognize that wellness and injury prevention are important topics. They're not public health topics. Now that's partly for resources and partly for politics. As soon as you start talking about death penalty, talking about gun control, you just lost most of your audience for real core public health. Because ironically, well, as we think of this touchy-feely public health as a liberal issue, public conservative politicians really love enforcement. Rethink schools of public health. Require everyone who has an MPH to be able to tell you a brown rat from a Norway rat, be able to inspect a restaurant, be able to tell you at least why you chlorinate water, if not how much, so that you could drop them down into the backwoods and have them do a little public health. Concentrate on the special skills of public health and don't duplicate other research departments. University of Texas School of Public Health, last time I looked, had some medical anthropologists. And they're wonderful people and do great work. They ought to be at the University of Texas main campus. There are only a handful of schools of public health, 26 of them, I think, last count, with relatively limited resources. And every single person at those facilities that does the same thing someone does in another university department is a waste of those resources. It's not to say schools of public health should just be dumbed down, but that with as limited resource base, there's no justification for allowing them to just duplicate what other university departments do as well or better. Don't try to save the world. In the clinical services area, don't try to say, well, we have to have public health in it. Go make the medical schools teach the medical students public health. If there's a single thing that probably improved public health on the clinical side more than anything, it would be if we could force the accreditation people to make every medical student get about 20 semester hours, or 20, not 20 hours, but you know, 20 hours worth of coursework over on public health. Epidemiology, basic public health services, you know, the sort of things that a medical school curriculum might have had 75 years ago. But we can't make up for their not learning it by trying to do it for them. Finally, I see public health, core public health, as focusing on the community. We have a lot of community rhetoric in public health now, but in fact, it's about individuals. I have an ecological model of the community, probably stemming back from my undergraduate days where I did a lot of ecology, environmental engineering, where we have an organism and we all contribute to the function of that organism. The organism is more than the sum of our individual needs. It means we have duties as well as rights, and we need to learn to use fear constructively again. Visit my webpage. There's a great article written, I think, in 1910 by Rosenau on the use of fear in public health. And he was the guy that developed what became Maxie Rosenau and Last, the first real preventive medicine textbook. And he talks about the importance of the community of being frightened enough to support public health. One of the things we've done in the last couple of decades is want to make everybody feel good about stuff so we'll empower them and we'll have a big consensus. I think that's been a disaster for public health. And I think we're seeing public health organizations realize that and start scaring people again. Bioterrorism, wonderful thing to get people's attention. I've seen folks starting to worry about bovine spongiform encephalitis to get people thinking about public health. That's a noble tradition. You shouldn't be embarrassed about it. Well, I'm going to turn the podium over to my fellow presenter. And then we'll talk, so I suspect that there's plenty of folks here that have lots of questions.
And now I'd like to introduce Dr. Adam Plank.